Hey, finance folk. My name is Aidas Palubinskas, and today I am going to chat with Mr. Boris Deschitere. He is the European External Action Services, EEAS, head of their sanctions division. The External Action Service is like the EU's foreign ministry. As friends of the podcast already know, it's DG FISMA, where I work, the Director General for Financial Stability, Financial Services, and Capital Markets Union, that prepares joint proposals for regulations on sanctions for adoption by the Council of the European Union and represents the European Commission in sanctions-related discussions with member states. The EEAS is our partner in all of this, especially when it comes to dealing with countries outside the EU. So, let's jump into action and take a look at sanctions from an external foreign policy perspective. Boris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Aidas.
I have to admit from the get-go that while my job is communicating on finance and sanctions, that I'm a bit of a foreign policy nerd. So I might geek out during this podcast episode, and I apologize in advance if I do, because these are some of my favorite subjects. Let's jump right into it. Everybody is talking about sanctions these days, especially in the context of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Why is it that sanctions seem to be so prominent in the foreign policy of the EU?
No, thanks, Aidas. I mean, first, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation. And if I try to address your question, I think I need to start a little bit with the definition of the terms, because many people don't understand very well what we are talking about when we're talking of sanctions. When we're talking of sanctions, we're talking first of a foreign policy tool. It's a foreign policy tool that is at the disposal of international actors. It can be the United Nations. It can be also autonomous measures that are taken by the European Union. If you look at the typology of those measures, you can have two main types. First, and somehow foremost, because this is the most popular type of tool, you have listings. You designate individuals or entities, and those individuals or entities will have an asset freeze of their assets inside the European Union. It will be prohibited to have business or financial relations with them for European Union actors. And third, you will have a travel ban. So particularly persons will not be allowed to travel inside the European Union. So the second aspect that we are very often talking about when we talk about sanctions is all what's related from internal market and economic relations. So we can also introduce sectoral measures, notably when we target entire sectors of the economy or specific categories of goods. I think on this, you already heard my colleagues from the Commission in previous podcasts, so I will not necessarily insist on that aspect.
We'll be linking to in the show notes to previous episodes that we did on sanctions, so the listeners will be able to come back to that.
Perfect. So to answer directly your question, indeed, we see that now sanctions are becoming an increasingly prominent tool of the EU's common foreign and security policy. And there are different reasons for this. The first and foremost, I think, is that the member states agree that there is value and importance for such measures. It's a very agile tool. It's scalable. You can adapt it to any circumstance. And that actually fits as an instrument to very various situations, and particularly as a complement when you want to take a political strategy to address specific issues. Now, of course, today we talk a lot of Russia, and I think that when people think of sanctions, they spontaneously think of Russia. It's normal. It has become effectively today the most prominent target of our sanctions. About half of our listings now concern Russia. We have in total 4,500 listings across the globe, more than 2,200 are just for Russia's invasion of Ukraine, plus a few others for other reasons that I can talk about later on Russia. And by the same token, the great majority of our sectoral measures, economic measures, concern Russia today. So it's really very much unprecedented. in terms of scope, in terms of impact, and also in terms of speed at which the first sanctions were adopted immediately after the invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Now, the other aspect that I think we need to highlight is that there is much more to sanctions. There are numerous other situations that are threatening international peace and security, other situations when we can see violations of international law, and that comes across all continents of the world, and that needs to be addressed. And I think one of the reasons why we see effectively this popularity is the awareness on the side of our member states that they dispose here of a tool that can support other of their actions. So, for example, we have sanctions on the DPRK. That's also UN legacy. We have sanctions on other actors in the Middle East, in Latin America, in Africa. And we also have sanction situations when sanctions are supporting political processes. So, for example, this is a case when we go after misappropriation of goods. We have specific regimes for this on Ukraine, on Moldova, on Tunisia, or when we want to support an internal political process like the recent package that was adopted on Guatemala. So all in all, you can see effectively a certain increase of the use of the tool. And to give you an example, in the past 12 months, we have, as a matter of fact, adopted 7 new regimes, including additional ones on Russia, like on human rights and the rule of law. And we have also met in the past 2 years more than a 50% increase in the number of designated individuals and entities.
You mentioned that the amount of sanctions that the EU has levied has increased a lot since Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine, annexation of Crimea in 2014. I guess that would probably be the when it really started. Or no, actually, of course, it would be the full-scale invasion. In my experience, the more you use a tool, the better you get at using that tool. So I guess my question that I'm getting to is, what has changed with Russia's invasion of Ukraine sanctions-wise? Have we gotten better at it? Is there any difference between what we did then, before, and now?
Yeah, first, maybe I should start by saying that Russia's aggression is, or has been, maybe we should say in English, a real systemic change and has had a major impact. That major impact was in many different respects. I mentioned already the scale of the sanctions that have been increased. I think we have had also to invest more resources in identifying targets, and more resources on the side of our colleagues of the Commission in identifying the appropriate measures. One of the points with sanctions is that you have a kind of a cat and mouse process, if you want. The more you take measures, the more those who are the subject of those measures will see where the loopholes can be, will take measures that will allow them some form of evasion, some form of circumvention. And you therefore need constantly to put yourself into question and to effectively bring forward different approaches, different measures. The second aspect that I would like to highlight is also that there is an evolution of the policy agenda. And Russia evidently, to address your question, will continue to shape that policy agenda. But what I mean here is that we need also, and that's why I spoke of agility of the tool, to address the rising security challenges that we can have, some of which are raised by Russia, some of which are raised by other actors. And the sanctions tool helps to address those new challenges. In the very, very case of Russia, for example, we took effectively measures on Ukraine. We also took a drone regime that is looking at the nexus that exists between Iran and Russia in terms of the delivery of those drones coming out of Iran to support Russia's war efforts. And that drone regime was extended recently to cover a wider geographic base to effectively address also other security challenges. I'll take another example, and is purely Russia related. I mentioned this quickly before. We've adopted a new regime on human rights and the rule of law that came immediately after the death of Mr. Navalny. But that was not just a response to it, not just addressing it, which was also done through another tool, the global human rights regime. It's also actually addressing the evolution that we see inside Russia and the threats that this can represent to us. Related to it, I will mention also the use of the cyber sanctions tool. We have just adopted 2 weeks ago new designations also in Russia in relation to the use of the cyber tool to attack, basically as part of the hybrid aggression against Europe. So as you can see, sanctions are quite varied. They also are here to protect the EU citizens. I think it's an important factor to mention here. There is another aspect that I want to highlight when we talk, I would say, of the evolution of the policy agenda, which is that evidently, the more we use the tool, the more the tool also has an impact on our partners. And I think we need to acknowledge here that the unprecedented economic and political scale of the sanctions vis-à-vis Russia has also generated or accelerated other foreign policy implications or trends. Some of them, we may see them from our perspective as positive. We have more coordination of the like-minded, more G7 coordination. We see also more, I would say, subjects for dialogue with third partners. But this has also raised specific challenges. Particularly, there is quite a wide range of countries that don't necessarily want to align on our sanctions. So that has invited us effectively to increase and improve our dialogue with those third partners. And another aspect here, maybe to highlight, and I think another intervention in this podcast stressed that already, but this is changing some of the political dynamics with partners like Turkey, like Central Asia, because we have a challenge also, which is to combine our various expectations in terms of combating or denouncing the circumvention, and at the same time, keep a positive political agenda and keep a positive engagement with those partners, which is the fundamental aim that we are having. So all of this necessitates quite a strong effort of explanation of the purpose of our sanctions, that they are peaceful, why we are taking them, and why we feel the need to take them, notably in response to violations of the UN Charter.
Understood. I want to jump back a little bit to something that you mentioned earlier, listings. You mentioned that more than half the listings that the EU has made now relate to Russia, and that's something I find very interesting. But you mentioned that listings are the asset freezes, travel bans, things. How does that process work? How does the EU decide who is going to be listed, and how do we do it?
So you want us to talk a bit of internal cuisine?
Well, just a little bit. Don't go into lots of details, because we haven't talked about listings in any great amount in previous podcasts about sanctions. So I think the listeners are going to find this interesting.
I think that first, it's important to underline that we are not taking sanctions on entities or individuals for the sake of it. When we take sanctions, they are taken when the behavior of actors is conducive or supportive of a certain political action that we want to counter, and that in most cases we actually see as illegal in the terms of the UN Charter. So it's therefore a political determination, and I think it's quite important to understand that there is therefore this distinction, and that it's in a nutshell, if I may say, not like a criminal case. Uh-huh. It's actually a political determination. Now, the second point to highlight is that even though it's political, there is primacy of law. So all the EU listings are based on international or EU legislation, allowing us to adopt such measures. I mentioned them. It's freezing companies' assets, can be imposing travel ban, can be prohibiting financial transactions. And a person or an entity needs, therefore, to meet certain criteria for us to be able to list them. So we do not list people indiscriminately, if you want. And there is a strong legal component to it, a strong legal component that we must respect, and respecting also the individual rights of individuals and companies. We do two types. On occasions, we transpose the UN regimes. We transpose all UN regimes anyway. It's our obligation by international law. So they may contain listings. And in other cases, we will take listings as a form of autonomous measures. If we take autonomous measures, for each individual and entity, a pack of evidence of this behavior must be collected. For that, member states, but also us in EAS, we can make proposals in this regards. And those proposals, therefore, of an entity or a person, and those proposals will be then discussed by the member states, and the decision will be taken by unanimity by the member states. The evidence pack, as we call it, is built on open sources. Those sources can be very multiple. It can be, for example, an investigative article by a journalist. It can be trade data. Sometimes it can even be claims from the individuals themselves, some public statements that they made. So, and therefore, it's very varied. Why do we use open source, which is also a question we often have? It's because in case an entity or an individual wants to make a claim at the EU Court of Justice, then the file will be accessible to their lawyers, will be accessible to the court. So we have only very exceptionally used classified information, but usually we find through open sources enough elements to effectively go for those listings. The third factor that I want to highlight is also the transparency. We are transparent in our measures. What I mean here is that all the listings adopted by the EU are public. Information about the persons, about the entities can be easily found in the EU's legal acts. They are published on internet. Just need to go on the relevant website, either of the Council, of the Commission, or the EAS to find them. And we publish, therefore, the sanctions as well as the reasons for which the people are being listed. So it's a very different, for example, from the attitude that you see in other countries that take sanctions against individuals and do not inform about them, namely, in this case, Russia. Russia has, for example, taken quite substantial designations against members of the European Parliament, against EU officials, against EU diplomats. But those lists are not made public, and you don't have any way to actually come back on them and make a claim that you should not be on those lists.
Well, as though a claim would go anywhere in a country that isn't ruled by the rule of law.
That's true. And as you speak of rule of law, we actually have on our side effectively the implementation of the rule of law, not just with the Court of Justice, but also because we are ourselves also reviewing regularly the sanctions regime. So it means that a change of behavior can lead to a delisting if all member states agree. So that's also quite, I think, important to take note of that. And this is a process that we've done already quite regularly to effectively delist people for a change of behavior.
I think it's probably important to note before I go on to my next question that, as far as I'm aware, appeals to the European Court of Justice by people who have been listed are only very rarely successful, which means that the process that you guys are going through to list them, as you mentioned, open, transparent, and based on open source information, obviously builds a very strong case. And that's why, you know, I mean, I can probably count on one hand the instances I know where somebody successfully appealed their listing.
Yeah, that is correct. And in all the cases that I have, at least to my knowledge, the issues were related to the weakness of the evidence. And that's always a challenge to effectively gather the necessary evidence more than the criteria that were effectively applied. And I think it's normal, and I think it's healthy that we see such a process. It's also helping us to improve effectively the way that we're collecting evidence. It's helping us to improve the criteria that we are using and ultimately improve the implementation of the rule of law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I know that some of the people on the list are very public and vocal in their propaganda, and this is leading to my next question. The Russians are expending a huge amount of human resources and monetary resources in disinformation campaigns about sanctions efficacy. They say sanctions aren't working, get rid of sanctions, or sanctions are hurting too much, get rid of sanctions. But one of the most important thrusts of their disinformation campaign is to convince us, Europeans, that sanctions are not reaching their aims. What do you say to people who say that sanctions aren't working, that they're not achieving their goals?
I think the first thing is that it's evident, and I think without a doubt, that there's already been quite an important impact of EU sanctions, but also of our other partner sanctions on Russia. And if you just look at the impact on prices, I mean, inflation, you have an inflation is 2 to 3 times higher than is the case here. You see also the recent evolution of the currency. You see the level of the interest rate, which in 15-16% now in Russia. And you see, I think, quite importantly, in the loss of energy revenues. Gazprom registered its first losses and are quite substantial, several billion dollars. And you see as well just the overall figures of where foreign direct investment is going, or rather where it's not going in the case of Russia. So there is an impact, but it's not an impact that is absolute in the sense that some people sometimes have an expectation for. First, it's relatively slow and it's normal. It's not the sort of economic shock that brings down suddenly an economy. There is in any economy a fair level of resilience. And I think we have to acknowledge that the Russian economy has been quite resilient from that perspective. And the second aspect is that the sanctions like we've taken were not meant to bring down completely the economy. What they are meant to do is to address three main aims. One is to reduce the revenue streams helping Russia to finance its war. One is to go after the military-industrial complex of Russia and effectively prevent it from being as efficient as it would be otherwise. And the third for us is also to negate the artificial political realities that Russia is trying to shape, particularly in the occupied territories of Ukraine, including via the various propaganda outlets. So I'd like, in fact, to say here that it's important to understand that sanctions are meant, I mean, particularly in this case, to disrupt, and that effectively the strategies that we have followed has been to disrupt those activities, make procurement more complex, make the routes more complicated, increase basically the price of leading a foreign policy based on aggression like Russia is leading. Another aspect that I want to highlight is that as we are taking sanctions, there's also within the sanctions a political signal. And that signal is the signal that we are determined to continue. And I would mean here the repetition of the packages. We already have 14 packages. They are more and more turning on the screws. They are more and more having an impact, and that's also a signal that we cannot accept such behavior globally. The signal to Russia can also be a signal to other actors. And notably, importantly, we cannot accept such behavior on the European soil and just sit idle when international norms are shattered.
Okay, let's turn away from Russia for just a little bit. I've read articles that maybe the EU is looking at Russia or turning its attention to Russia too much. Is the EU turning a blind eye to other countries when it comes to sanctions? Do we have the time and the human resources to do the globe?
I wouldn't say that. I think that if you look at the situation, I mean, I was mentioning the use or the growing use of the sanctions tool before. And the EU is actually continuing also to use this tool to support response to various crises across different regions. I will mention Sudan, for example, which is an ongoing crisis. We've had others in the African context. And very recently, we used the sanctions tool as a response to the events of October 7th. We took further measures against Hamas. A specific new regime was created. We have a number of designations under this new regime. We've also taken measures against Israeli settlers in the context of violations to human rights, and we are continuing to do so. I was also mentioning before the case of Guatemala in Latin America. We have other countries in the area as well, and we continue to uphold other regimes that are legacy also from the UN, thinking particularly of the DPRK. We've also reinforced, as a matter of fact, our measures in relations to DPRK's link to Russia. I know it's bringing us back to Russia, but nevertheless, I think it ought to be mentioned. What's important also to say, and I think that's what I was somehow explaining at the beginning, but I'm happy to go more in the details, is that the sanctions are not taken as an end for themselves. There's also a lot of diplomacy that's happening behind the scenes. So in all these cases that I mentioned, you have also mediation, conflict prevention, you have a diplomatic engagement, and the sanctions are actually one of the elements that the EU is using. But you have to see that sanctions are part of what we call the integrated approach, notably for the management of external crisis. So that, I think, is also very important to highlight. And that's why also it's delicate when you compare different sanctions one from another, because each regime of sanctions is actually coming on top of a policy that already exists to address a specific situation or crisis.
Okay, let's come back to diplomacy a little. How much do you see the rest of the world either cooperating with or ignoring our sanctions? There's probably less appetite for sanctions in the UN Security Council, and there are more and more autonomous sanctions. What do you think about that?
I think it takes us to a reflection of it, a bit of a different nature and beyond the sanctions per se. I think it's a reality today that we see that there is more fragmentation politically. We see the effect of that fragmentation with a growing willingness from a number of our partners not to take specific sides. And I think we must respect that. We should even welcome that. And we still believe, however, on our side, that we cannot stay passive when it comes to the violations of the principles of the UN Charter. So when we are addressing, and I would say when we are reaching out, engaging those partners who don't want to take sides, we don't miss any occasion to make those comments and to effectively highlight that the EU's foreign policy is based on those principles that are inspired by the UN Charter. That takes me maybe to make two quick remarks here. First, I think sanctions are working, to come back to your previous question, because they are also about leveraging a sort of competitive advantage on globalization. Competitive advantage from the EU, but also from partners, particularly when we take sanctions and are coordinated with others like the US, the UK, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and a number of other partners. But in return, this means that we need to respond with having the good political calibration in consideration of each and every situation when a tool is used. I mentioned before the integrated approach that I would say is vis-a-vis your own EU policy. But what I mean here is to be well calibrated also in terms of the language we use or in terms of the choice of using the sanctions tool. And I think we acknowledge, and we will be the first ones to say this, sanctions are not always the best response. It's never a panacea. And again, when we use them, it's because we feel we had no other alternative but to go to that stage. The second remark that I want to highlight, and that for us is, I would say, one of the main elements of our narrative when we're engaging third countries, is also to think of what can happen if there is impunity of action. I mean, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a very obvious example. The respect for territorial integrity is a very fundamental norm on which the whole international order, on which the whole security of states rest today. So what does happen? What consequence does it have if effectively no one responds to this? And here that takes me to highlight, and I think that was part of your question, that the UN Security Council is today increasingly constrained because effectively you see this fragmentation by the fact that Russia is exerting a veto, that is making it more and more difficult at the UN Security Council to take decisions that can be in the order of restrictive measures. So there is a recent example of the refusal of the panel of experts for the DPRK. And we have, therefore, to respond to this, or I would say naturally the response to this means that we need to have autonomous measures that are coordinated with like-minded partners. And that's increasingly important now, and that will very likely continue to be extremely important in the coming period. Here, if I may add, we have sometimes different legal bases, sometimes different scopes of our sanctions with our partners, for example, on extraterritoriality with the US, but having this coordination has extremely important political and practical implications, notably, for example, on the quality of the political message, but also to reduce the scope of permissible actions by entities that would not respect international law. And here, evidently, we can think of all the sectoral measures we're taking on Russia. So if I can just make a general conclusive comment, I would say that that allows, I think, to consider that sanctions are effectively a particularly peaceful tool, in the sense that this is the most peaceful tool that we can have in response to a violation of law, notably in response to a war. And that this is also a tool that allows us to uphold, I would say, our role as an EU of law-abiding nations globally to the UN Charter and to basically international rules. And I think that by doing this, we should highlight that this is, as a matter of fact, setting a healthy vision of the world, peaceful vision of the world, and we hope an example that others can follow, or if they don't follow, at least support.
Brice, I would love to keep on talking about this subject with you for on and on and on, but I know that you're a very, very busy man, and so I'm going to thank you very much for coming to the podcast, enlightening us about sanctions as a foreign policy tool. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Emilien. It was a great pleasure, and it will always be a pleasure to come back to your podcast at any time.
Okay, here's my take on this. The European External Action Service and the EU Commission work hand in hand on EU sanctions. It's a symbiotic relationship that ensures that the EU has a strong, coherent sanctions policy as an effective part of its foreign policy toolbox. Sanctions aren't just about Russia, though naturally Russia's ongoing war against Ukraine and European values makes those sanctions much more visible. EU sanctions work. No matter what some disinformation campaigns might be telling you via social media, they work. If they didn't, do you think those rogue regimes would be begging for sanctions to be lifted? I think not. That's it for today. Thanks for joining me. Do please tell others about the podcast. Like and subscribe. Give us a good rating on whatever platform you're listening on. It helps spread the word. Bye!